What's it for? Is that what you want to know? You want to know what this is all about? Is that it, Gelfly? You don't know? You've never looked at the heavens. Everything in the heavens is here, moving as the heavens move. This is how to know when. That's what. Suns, moons, stars. Yes, the angle of eternity. That's how I know it's coming. How else can I make the prediction? 1,000 years ago, there was a great conjunction. I was there. 3 suns lined up. That's when the crystal cracked. That's when the Skeksis appeared. And the mystics. Another great conjunction coming up. Anything could happen. The whole world might burn up. End of Augur. Better have your shard before that, carefully. Now, ask what the Great Conjunction is. What's the Great Conjunction?
What's the Great Conjunction? You tell me.
The Great Conjunction is the end of the world. Oh, the beginning? End, begin, all the same. Big change.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We're gonna stay here all night if we have to, so let's get started.
Can I go when this starts to suck?
Suicide is a suicide. Suicide is a suicide. Suicide is a suicide.
Who made this world? Where my wife's man and her husband are not one and the same, where poets are extremely talented but some of them vain, act like they'd be willing to bust one in your brain, especially when they start gunning for name. I swear, the more things change, the further I go insane. I'm shell-shocked. I ain't no good for no woman no more. Perhaps I should just barricade myself in here with my daughters. It don't seem correct to subject some innocent woman to my marriage-induced post-traumatic stress disorder. Sometimes I think this living room couch is going to become my from here on out living quarters. Now, eventually, after continuously waking up here, my eyes are just going to well up with water. I mean, a lesser man would just do it. But I would rather be crucified than commit suicide. And any hustler, whether they be dead or alive, would recognize that the look in my eyes is strictly do or die. Besides, people that commit suicide must not believe in God. Otherwise, they would understand that there's a rhyme and reasons why this life gets so hard, and they would put their nose to the grindstone and get used to the taste of their own blood, because life is a monster of a mobster. You got to get your chops up if you wish to associate with that known thug. This world is like the Wizard of Oz, and until you show some heart, you don't never get shown no love. So when you're feeling desperate, thinking you done gave all you got to give, and you ask yourself, who made this world? The answer is simple. You and your actions did. If you don't like the way that the life you live is changing, then isn't it just as obvious that you must live your life to change the way you live? Happiness is mathematic. That's all it is. Happiness is mathematic. That's all it is. Happiness is mathematic. That's all.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
In just a few moments, 9 of Uncle Sam's most powerful bombers will sweep out of the southeast in 2 separate flights, one at an altitude of 4,000 feet and the other at 15,000 feet, in simulated attack on military objectives in this vicinity. This attack will be the climax of the most intensive aerial maneuvers ever undertaken by the United States Army Air Corps. From our vantage point here at the Seversky Field, the Air Defense Headquarters of the 3rd Wing, under the command of Brigadier General Frederick L. Martin, the Special Features Division of the Mutual Network will bring you a description of the exciting events which are to take place in the next few minutes. From the defense headquarters on the ground and from the giant bombers themselves, Mutual will show peacetime America how the civilian population can cooperate with the military in defense against enemy air raids. A half mile away, the town of Farmingdale is a blaze of light.
Is a blaze of light.
Which, although in the center of a rich farming area, in time of war would be a strategic military focal point for air raids, because of 2 great aircraft factories which border this field. However, at the first sound of the approaching enemy air fleet, sirens atop the firehouse in Farmingdale and the nearby New York State College of Agriculture will shriek a warning to the entire population. The citizens have been drilling for this maneuver and been drilled by officers from the nearby General Headquarters Air Force Base at Mitchell Field, and will immediately extinguish their lights, plunging the circular area within a diameter of 5 miles into complete darkness.
The bigger you build the bonfire, the more darkness you will reveal.
In an endeavor to save from destruction these two factories which manufacture planes for our Air Corps. During the maneuver, Farmingdale will be defended by the 36th Pursuit Squadron of the 3rd Wing. 9 of these planes are now resting on the field before us, and at the sound of the warning siren, they will take to the air from this inky black field with nothing but the light of the moon to guide the pilots. Across the field, searchlight and anti-aircraft batteries of the 62nd Coast Artillery are in readiness to go into action to repel the invading air fleet. The scene, therefore, at Air Defense Headquarters is one of tense and watchful waiting. And a half mile away, quiet civilian population goes into its usual, unusual evening activity. And now, here at 10:32 is the warning order given by the Air Defense Commander, Brigadier General Frederick H. Martin of the 3rd Wing. To all defense establishments in the air defense area, the following message just received at Air Defense Headquarters from our warning net station at Lake Ronkonkoma. High-flying formation believed to be enemy bombers, now passing over, headed west. All defense establishments on the alert. All lights out in the air defense area. Go into action when the enemy appears. Pursuits, take off at once. And now we hear the sirens coming from atop the fire station over in Farmingdale, and we see the platoon of magnificent searchlights.
800 million candle power searchlights shining up in the air, given 3 beams.
Telling the people in Farmingdale and in that 5 mile area to turn off their lights and get ready. Now the planes are taking off. 9 pursuit planes. We've seen 1, 2. And now here goes the 4th and the 5th. These magnificent lights shining up in the air, meeting each other high miles overhead. Now we see number 6 of the plane, followed by number 7, and the pursuit planes are quickly off in the air to defend this field. I want to call to your attention that Farmingdale is not being defended, but the attack tonight will be on the area housing these two great airplane factories. Now we see the planes go up over above us. Lights are all extinguished. No lights any place within this whole section of the country. And so now a real simulation of war.
Sections of highway and local airspace have been closed in Guatemala as the Fuego volcano begins to belch fire and ash. Fuego, just 25 miles from Guatemala City, is spewing a cloud of debris 4.8 kilometers into the sky and launching a fountain of lava almost 1.3 kilometers high. Locals and experts say the eruption is the worst in recent years. Guatemala's 4 active volcanoes are a constant threat, though. In July 2010, an explosion at the Pacaya volcano, also around 25 miles from the capital, coated the city in a thick layer of black ash and rock.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
scene of devastation in Italy as the country's most powerful earthquake in 3 years kills at least three people. The 6.3 magnitude quake hit near Bologna in the north of the country. The tremor and a powerful aftershock shattered historical buildings throughout the region, including the 14th century Estense Castle in the town of San Felice sul Panaro. There are fears many more people could be trapped under the rubble.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Police in Thailand have arrested a British man over a suspected black magic ritual.
Black magic ritual?
Involving the dead bodies of babies. We'd like to warn you that you may find the following images disturbing. Police say the bodies of six children aged 7 months to 2 years were found stuffed in bags in a Bangkok hotel room. Some were covered in gold leaf. The suspect, 28-year-old Chow Hock Quen, is a British citizen born in Hong Kong. He's being held for possession of human remains. Police believe he was trying to smuggle the corpses to Taiwan and sell them to wealthy clients. It's not known where the bodies came from.
A dying Chevron executive is excited to one day become oil. A man wearing red glasses and pink pants is probably Dutch or something. And the report of a popular fish's death is starting to get around the tank. And now a summation of the cultural zeitgeist in an economical and easy to imbibe digital globule. This is the Onion Week in Review. According to alarming reports from international relief agencies, tens of thousands are dead this month in an ongoing Africa, plaguing the regions of Ethiopia, Chad, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, with millions more being affected by the highly lethal continent. The persistent and destructive Africa, which has been described by experts as the worst the area has seen in recent history, has killed 100 million people over the past 10 years, with thousands of children succumbing to Africa-related complications before the age of five. Graphic images of violent military crackdowns and vicious slaughter additionally confirm that large parts of Egypt, Sudan, and Somalia have once again collapsed into full-scale Africa. Baltimore onlookers said that Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood flipped out at a pothole located on the city's West Pratt Street Thursday, screaming for nearly 45 minutes at the 22-centimeter-wide, 8-centimeter-deep concrete depression. An enraged LaHood reportedly reamed the pothole out for being a, quote, goddamn disgrace that's trying to make him look like a fool. HBO executives revealed Monday the future of their hit series Game of Thrones is in question, as the series is quickly running out of unkempt and bedraggled old men to cast, saying the big crowd scenes in the show's second season have severely depleted the amount of greasy-haired and scraggly-bearded actors over 70. Showrunners stressed the importance of having at least one grimy and weather-beaten old man per episode.
Frankly, I don't know what we're going to do for the third season if we can't find more elderly and disheveled men to cast. We got several big war room scenes planned that are definitely going to call for old guys with scraggly beards just standing around.
The Game of Thrones crisis is just the latest in a series of casting difficulties for HBO, who in March revealed they had already used their annual allocation of Steve Buscemi. And in this week's op-ed pages, a local man talks about how he was always just one of those kids who was off by himself taking cats apart to see how they work.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Vimy Ridge, France, Easter Monday, 1917. After tireless preparation, against incredible odds, over 100,000 Canadian soldiers launched a massive attack. They surged from the trenches, dugouts, and tunnels, capturing a formidable German position. But success came at a high cost. 10,000 Canadians lay dead or wounded. Today, the Canadian National Vimy Memorial stands on land granted permanently to Canada by France as a tribute to the bravery and sacrifice of our servicemen and women. The victory at Vimy was not only crucial in ending the First World War, but sparked a coming of age for Canada, giving a young nation a sense of confidence and identity. It is with great pride that the Bank of Canada showcases its new $20 banknote, honoring a significant achievement in Canadian history. The leading-edge security features in Canada's banknotes make them easy to check and hard to counterfeit. A good way to check these high-quality new banknotes is to feel, look at, and flip them. First, notice the smooth texture of the note. It's made from a single piece of polymer. Feel the raised ink of the large number, the shoulders of the portrait, and the Bank of Canada text. Next, look at the note. Two transparent windows have security features in them, the large window and the frosted maple leaf window. In the large window, look at the metallic portrait that matches the large portrait and the metallic building. Look at the details and then tilt the note. Notice the sharp color changes in the building. The color changes in the portrait are more subtle. In and around the window, you can see small numbers. Some of them are reversed. Some of them are reversed. Some of them are reversed. Some of the leaves that border the window cross into it. Flip the banknote over. You will see the same security features in the large window on the front, repeated in the same colors and detail on the back. There's one more security feature you can check if you're still unsure that a note is real. You will need a small light source that's about a meter away from you. From the front of the note, locate the frosted maple leaf window and bring it right up to your eye.
Look at the light through the window.
A circle of numbers matching the note's value will appear. Not only are these notes more secure, they are also more durable and will circulate longer under normal handling conditions. Canada's new polymer banknotes. Secure, durable, innovative.
That's the cool breeze of freedom right there.
Well, happy Schuman Day, or Europe Day as you now call it, although I thought the celebrations were rather muted. The only bit of real passion we had was Mr. Schultz slagging off the English, but that now appears to be the sort of popular sport in this Parliament. And when people stand up and talk about the great success that the EU has been, I'm not sure anybody saying it really believes it themselves anymore. I think we're celebrating the wrong day. We shouldn't be celebrating the 9th of May. We should be celebrating the 8th of May, Victory in Europe Day. We should celebrate the last time the Germans tried to smash the continent and they foundered, and at least half the continent got its democracy back. What we're celebrating on the 9th of May is another attempt, through different means, to smash democracy across Europe. I don't doubt for a minute that Jean Monnet was well-intentioned at the start. He thought that if you abolish nation-states, you would stop there ever being another war. He didn't at the time, of course, have the benefit of seeing that theory as it played out in Yugoslavia. But like communism, this has all gone badly wrong. And the EU Titanic has now hit the iceberg. It is a European Union of economic failure, of mass unemployment, of low growth, but worst of all, it's an EU with the economic prison of the euro. And this now poses huge dangers to the continent. We face the prospect of mass civil unrest, possibly even revolution, in some countries that are being driven into total and utter desperation. But there is perhaps an opportunity. There is perhaps some good news. That now a democratic rebellion has begun. It began in Finland last year with the True Finns getting nearly 20% of the vote. And we're seeing in country after country new political movements on the right and the left making big scores. But that may not all be good news. Because in Greece what we saw last Sunday was rather reminiscent of the German election of 1932. We saw the status quo centre collapse and the extremes of right and left rise. You know, this project could even cause the rebirth of national socialism in Europe. We are headed the wrong way. We must break up the Eurozone. We must set those Mediterranean countries free. We must try to build a Europe. I want a Europe, but a Europe based on trade,
A Europe based on cooperation. A Europe based on us sitting round the table and agreeing sensible rules on crime and the environment. We can do all of those things, but we cannot do it if we're asked to rally behind that flag. I owe no allegiance to that flag, and nor to most of the people in Europe either.
It could have been the simple tale of one friend helping another. Except the two in this story are a fugitive Russian oligarch and a cousin of Britain's Queen Elizabeth. London-based Boris Berezovsky has given Prince Michael of Kent more than $500,000 of financial support, raising questions over what a wanted man in Russia wants in return. Ivor Bennett takes up the story.
Two men are said to be very close, but were these payments just a friendly exchange, or was there something more to it? Both sides have been very keen to play down any shady implication here, stressing that everything was above board. Boris Berezovsky has come out and said that there was nothing underhand. He's called it just a matter between friends. And Prince Michael of Kent, who's the Queen's first cousin, their fathers were brothers. His spokesperson has said that everything was conducted properly and all the appropriate tax was paid on these payments. There were 56 payments made in total over the years between 2002 and 2008 to one of Prince Michael's offshore companies, amounting to a massive £320,000, so over $500,000. And serious questions still remain over these cash payments, such as what was the money used for and why was it needed? Neither questions answered so far by either party. Berezovsky's lawyer, however, has said that his client neither sought nor obtained any benefit from this friendship. However, it's certainly worth noting here that Berezovsky, at the time of the first payments, was and still is on the run from the Russian government. He used to be one of the country's richest men. He was highly influential, but in 2000 he fled to the UK after an investigation was launched into his assets. So whilst he was seeking a political asylum here, he was actually convicted in Russia in absentia in 2007 for embezzlement. He's been living here ever since. And obviously it was in his interest that he should be allowed to stay in the UK despite numerous extradition requests from Russia. Now, he said that there was nothing in it for him, but the fact that substantial cash payments were made to a member of the royal family here, it certainly begs the question, why were these payments made?
Yellow model chick, yellow bottle sipping, yellow Lamborghini, yellow top missing. Yup, yup, that stuff looked like a toupee. I get what you get in 10 years, in 2 days.
Ladies love me, I'm on my cool J. If you get what I get,
what would you say? He whacks it on and off, Mr. Miyagi. And them suicide doors, Arikari. Look at me now, look at me now. I'm getting paper, look at me now, look at me now.
In times of austerity, it's the bloated elephant in the room that no one seems to want to tackle. Yeah, I'm talking about the Pentagon budget. A new survey shows that the public is ready for some deep cuts. An overwhelming majority from both parties support cutting the defense budget. Here's a look at that survey. Two-thirds of Republicans support slashing funding, and 9 in 10 Democrats are singing the same tune. But this seems to be at odds with political leaders, with the headlines saying it all. Take a look. House passes bill undoing defense cuts. House GOP pits Pentagon versus the poor. And House votes to spare Pentagon from automatic budget cuts, trims domestic programs instead. So why is it that elected leaders and the American people don't see eye to eye when it comes to defense spending? To talk about this, I'm joined by retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor.
Everywhere, like, such as?
Hey, Douglas. So it seems like everyone across the board can agree that, you know, we need to cut the Pentagon. Why is it that the Pentagon is not being cut?
Little finger bigger than gorilla, because I'm killing every jigger that try to beat on my stuff. Better cuff your man if you want him. I can get him because he accidentally slip and fall on my crack. Oops, I said on my crack. I didn't really mean to say on my crack. But since we talking about my crack, all you haters say hi to that. I'm done. No, really, though, I'm not done.
Let's go.
Because I'm feeling like I'm running and I'm feeling like I gotta get away, get away, get away. But I know that I don't. Cause you know I gotta win every day, day. See, they don't really, really wanna pop me. Just know that you will never stop me. And I know that I can be a little cocky. Oh, you ain't never gonna flop me. Every time I come a jigger, gotta set it, then I gotta go, and then I gotta get it, then I gotta blow, and then I gotta shatter any little thing a jigger think it'd be doing. Cause it doesn't matter, cause I'm gonna then I'm gonna murder everything and anything about a boom, about a bing. I gotta do a lot of things to make it clear to a couple jiggers that I'm always winning, and I gotta get it again and again and again.
First, this sort of support for bloated defense spending has been eroding for some time. The American people have simply walked away from these interventions. So this new data is not surprising. But there's a second problem, and that is that defense spending doesn't necessarily equate to real military capability. Defense spending is really involved with a lot of redistribution of taxpayer income to various states and districts across the country. So while collectively people say, by all means, cut defense, when you begin to look at what's likely to go away, people say, well, wait a minute, that's going to cost me my job. I'm not going to get reelected. I will lose money in my district, in my state. And so that's the real rub at this point.
I mean, isn't this just a vicious cycle, though?
And I be doing it to death, and now I move a little phallic, jigger, better color up, and everybody know my style, jigger, know that I'm the best. When I come, I'm doing this, and I be banging on my chest, and I'm banging in the east, and I'm banging in the west, and I come to give you more, and I will never give you less. You will hear it in the street, and you go read it in the press. Do you really want to know what's next? See the way we on it when we all up in the race, and you know we gotta go, don't try to keep up with the pace, and we struggle in a hustle, and sending it, and getting it, and always gotta do it, take it to another place, gotta taste it, and I gotta grab it, and I gotta cut through all this traffic, just to be at the top of the throne, gotta know I gotta have it, gotta have it. Look at me now.
Democrats don't want to appear weak on national security, so they have to keep saying, you know, we're strong on national security. They can't appear weak. And then you have the Republicans. Mitt Romney doesn't really have national service in his family, so he's like putting forward all of these crazy, you know, increases to the military. Yeah. I mean, how is this ever going to end?
Man, forget these haters. How y'all doing? I'm Lil Toonchi. I'm a nuisance. I go stupid. I go dumb like the Three Stooges. I don't eat sushi. I'm the stuff. No pollution, no substitution. Now I'm chilling, playing movies in my jacuzzi. Fruit is juicy. I never give a damn about a hater. Got money on my radar. Dressed like a skater. Got a big house. Came with an elevator. You jiggas ain't eating. Go tell a waiter. Molly said shoot him. And I said, okay, you on that bullshit. I'm like, Olay. Don't care what you say. So don't even speak. Your boyfriend a freak like Cirque du Soleil. That's word to my flag. And my flag red. I'm out of my head. Yo, I'm out of my mind. From the bottom I climb, you ain't harder than mine. Nope, not on my time, not even trying. What's poppin' slime? Nothing vibing. If they trippin', forgettin' five. Ain't got no time to shuck and jive. These jiggas as sweet as pumpkin pie. So rockin' Sprite on a private flight. Yo, I've been Tyson's guiding light. And my pocket's white, my diamond's white. My mama's nice and my daddy's gone. Yo, peace be scared, cause I'm too wild. Been here for a while, I was like, no try. I put it down, I'm so young money. You got eyes, look at me now. Oh, look at me now. Look at me now. I'm getting paper. Look at me now. Look at me now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Rush the mud. What? Okay. Okay. Is that right? I'm fresh.
That is just total denial. Joining me tonight, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
The circumstances surrounding J.P. Morgan, is how big an opportunity is this right now?
I think it calls attention to the recklessness and the greed of Wall Street. It reminds people that 4 years ago, these people on Wall Street forced this country into the worst recession since the 1930s, forced us to have to bail them out. And while Dodd-Frank was a step forward, it did not go far enough. The American people are angry at Wall Street. You know what they want? They want our financial institutions to invest in the real economy. They want Wall Street to be lending money to businesses so we can create jobs. They do not want Wall Street involved in a gambling casino, waging risky bets and losing substantial sums of money and threatening the entire economy.
How hard is it going to be for the Senate to do what the American people want them to do when Wall Street is so terribly influential and some say the banks own the Senate?
Well, and let me tell you what many others might not tell you. Some people think, well, gee, the Congress regulates Wall Street. I think the truth is that Wall Street regulates the Congress.
Supercars are an obvious sign of your knack for making money. They aren't necessarily a sign of your knack for driving, though, as this motorist in suburban Chicago discovered.
I got that on video.
Well, their driving may not be up to much, but they can park in the smallest of spaces. Maybe it's time to downgrade to something a little more manageable.
The real problem with the city is Lamborghinis.
An Oak Park woman goes before a judge. Her crime? Growing vegetables in her yard.
Turns out that a veggie garden in front of the house is against the city code. Fox News' Alexis Wiley reports.
The price of organic food is kind of through the roof.
So why not grow your own?
These are pepper plants. This one is a jalapeno. You can see there's a little baby jalapeno right here, which is super cute and one of our favorites.
But Julie Bass's garden is a little unique because it's in her front yard.
We thought it'd be really cool to do it so the neighbors could see. The kids love it. The kids from the neighborhood all come and help.
But Julie's cool garden has landed her in hot water with the city of Oak Park. Code enforcement gave her a warning, then a ticket, and now she's been charged with a misdemeanor.
I think it's sad that the city of Oak Park, that's already strapped for cash, is paying a lot of money to have a prosecutor bothering us.
That's not what we want to see in our front yard.
Why? Well, the city is pointing to a code that says a front yard has to have suitable live plant material. But here's the big question. What's suitable?
You're listening to the sound of plants communicating.
Back in the 70s, there was a lot of research about plant consciousness, and some of this was had to do with the fact that plants reacted to signals that were coming from other plants, and these could be detected very much like the sensors we have here. In fact, Clive Baxter was a man who had lie detector equipment, wired plants up, found that one plant that wasn't wired up would react to harm that the plant that was hooked up and vice versa. So you had this plant symbiosis of signals, something like some field phenomena happening between plants. He even went so far as to hook up shrimp that were on a timer, and at a certain point the shrimp would fall into scalding water, and the scalding water, they would die immediately, and the plant on the electroencephalogram would go wah, just the signal would go crazy. It'd be screaming, essentially feeling the demise of the shrimp. I'm thinking that it's possible that by running these signals through audio processors, sophisticated ones, that we're revealing more of what's in the signal, not just adding something to a simple pitch shift. because of the fact that there's a complex biology involved, that we're opening that signal up. The more it opens up, the more it seems the plants want to do. The more range you give them of expression, the more they seem to work with that range and produce an incredible deeper effects. Just like there, all of a sudden I'm talking about it, and the next thing we know, the thing's boosting itself right up. You know, so there's this funny reciprocity between the plant and the operator and whatever else is going on in the room. You put on some music, all of a sudden they seem to be pegging themselves to the music. Is that a magnetic phenomena or is that a biological phenomena? I can't say, you know, but it's wild to see it. These things are also interacting with other invisible realms. I mean, how do I know that there isn't a gnome living in that tree that's taking advantage of this to express itself, you see?
Old, I went off to summer camp for the first time, and my mother packed me a suitcase full of books, which to me seemed like a perfectly natural thing to do, because in my family, reading was the primary group activity. And this might sound antisocial to you, but for us, it was really just a different way of being social. You had the animal warmth of your family sitting right next to you, but you were also free to go roaming around the adventure land inside your own mind. And I had this idea that camp was going to be just like this, but better. I had a vision of 10 girls sitting in a cabin, cozily reading books in their matching nightgowns. Camp was more like a keg party without any alcohol. And on the very first day, our counselor gathered us all together, and she taught us a cheer that she said we would be doing every day for the rest of the summer to instill camp spirit. And it went like this. R-O-W-D-I-E, that's the way we spell rowdy, 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 let's get rowdy. Yeah. So I couldn't figure out for the life of me why we were supposed to be so rowdy, or why we had to spell this word incorrectly. But I recited the cheer along with everybody else. I did my best. And I just waited for the time that I could go off and read my books. But the first time that I took my book out of my suitcase, the coolest girl in the bunk came up to me and she asked me, why are you being so mellow? Mellow, of course, being the exact opposite of R-O-W-D-I-E. And then the second time I tried it, the counselor came up to me with a concerned expression on her face, and she repeated the point about camp spirit and said we should all really work very hard to be outgoing. And so I put my books away, back in their suitcase, and I put them under my bed, and there they stayed for the rest of the summer. And I felt kind of guilty about this. I felt as if the books needed me somehow, and they were calling out to me, and I was forsaking them. But I did forsake them, and I didn't open that suitcase again until I was back home with my family at the end of the summer. Now, I tell you this story about summer camp. I could have told you 50 others just like it. All the times that I got the message that somehow my quiet and introverted style of being was not necessarily the right way to go, and that I should be trying to pass as more of an extrovert. And I always sensed deep down that this was wrong, and that introverts were pretty excellent just as they were. But for years, I denied this intuition. And so, I became a Wall Street lawyer, of all things, instead of the writer that I had always longed to be, partly because I needed to prove to myself that I could be bold and assertive, too. And I was always going off to crowded bars when I really would have preferred to just have a nice dinner with friends. And I made these self-negating choices so reflexively that I wasn't even aware that I was making them. Now, this is what many introverts do, and it's our loss for sure, but it is also our colleagues' loss and our community's loss. And at the risk of sounding grandiose, it is the world's loss, because when it comes to creativity and to leadership, we need introverts doing what they do best. A third to a half of the population are introverts. A third to a half. So that's one out of every two or three people you know. So even if you're an extrovert yourself, you know, I'm talking about your coworkers and your spouses and your children and the person sitting right next to you right now. All of them subject to this bias that is pretty deep and real in our society. We all internalize it from a very early age without even having a language for what we're doing. Now, to see the bias clearly, you need to understand what introversion is. And it's different from being shy. Shyness is about fear of social judgment. Introversion is more about how do you respond to stimulation, including social stimulation. So extroverts really crave large amounts of stimulation, whereas introverts feel at their most alive and they're most switched on and they're most capable when they're in quieter, more low-key environments. Not all the time, you know, these things are an absolute, but a lot of the time. So the key then to maximizing our talents is for us all to put ourselves in the zone of stimulation that is right for us. But now here's where the bias comes in. Our most important institutions, our schools and our workplaces, they are designed mostly for extroverts, and for extroverts' need for lots of stimulation. And also, we are living through this belief system. We have a belief system right now that I call the new groupthink, which holds that all creativity and all productivity comes from a very oddly gregarious place. So if you picture the typical classroom nowadays, when I was going to school, we sat in rows. We sat in rows of desks like this, and we did most of our work pretty autonomously. But nowadays, your typical classroom has pods of desks of 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 kids all facing each other. And kids are working in countless group assignments, even in subjects like math and creative writing, which you would think would depend on solo flights of thought. Kids are now expected to act as committee members. And for the kids who prefer to go off by themselves or just to work alone, those kids are seen as outliers often, or worse, as problem cases. And the vast majority of teachers reports believing that the ideal student is an extrovert as opposed to an introvert, even though introverts actually get better grades and are more knowledgeable, according to research. Okay, same thing is true in our workplaces. We now, most of us, work in open plan offices without walls, where we are subject to the constant noise and gaze of our coworkers. And when it comes to leadership, introverts are routinely passed over for leadership positions, even though introverts tend to be very careful, much less likely to take outsized risks, which is something we might all favor nowadays. And interesting research by Adam Grant at the Wharton School has found that introverted leaders often deliver better outcomes than extroverts do, because when they are managing proactive employees, they're much more likely to let those employees run with their ideas, whereas an extrovert can quite unwittingly kind of get so excited about things that they're putting their own stamp on things, and other people's ideas might not as easily then bubble up to the surface. Now, in fact, some of our transformative leaders in history have been introverts. I'll give you some examples. Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks, Gandhi. All these people described themselves as quiet and soft-spoken and even shy. And they all took the spotlight, even though every bone in their bodies was telling them not to. And this turns out to have a special power all its own, because people could feel that these leaders were at the helm, not because they enjoyed directing others, and not out of the pleasure of being looked at. They were there because they had no choice, because they were driven to do what they thought was right. Now, I think at this point it's important for me to say that I actually love extroverts. I always like to say some of my best friends are extroverts, including my beloved husband. And we all fall at different points, of course, along the introvert-extrovert spectrum. You know, even Carl Jung, the psychologist who first popularized these terms, said that there's no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert. He said that such a man would be in a lunatic asylum if he existed at all. And some people fall smack in the middle of the introvert-extrovert spectrum, and we call these people ambiverts, and I often think that they have the best of all worlds. But many of us do recognize ourselves as one type or the other, and what I'm saying is that culturally, we need a much better balance. We need more of a yin and yang between these two types. Now, this is especially important when it comes to creativity and to productivity, because when psychologists look at the lives of the most creative people, what they find are people who are very good at exchanging ideas and advancing ideas, but who also have a serious streak of introversion in them. And this is because solitude is a crucial ingredient often to creativity. So Darwin, you know, he took long walks alone in the woods and emphatically turned down dinner party invitations. Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, he dreamed up many of his amazing creations in a lonely bell tower office that he had in the back of his house in La Jolla, California. And he was actually afraid to meet the young children who read his books for fear that they were expecting him to be this kind of jolly Santa Claus-like figure and would be disappointed with his more reserved persona. Steve Wozniak invented the first Apple computer, sitting alone in his cubicle in Hewlett-Packard, where he was working at the time. And he says that he never would have become such an expert in the first place had he not been too introverted to leave the house when he was growing up. Now, of course, this does not mean that we should all stop collaborating. And case in point is Steve Wozniak famously coming together with Steve Jobs to start Apple Computer. But it does mean that solitude matters, and that for some people, it is the air that they breathe. And in fact, we have known for centuries about the transcendent power of solitude. It's only recently that we've strangely begun to forget it. If you look at most of the world's major religions, you will find seekers, Moses, Jesus, Buddha, Mohammed, seekers who are going off by themselves, alone, to the wilderness, where they then have profound epiphanies and revelations that they then bring back to the rest of the community. So no wilderness, no revelations. This is no surprise, though, if you look at the insights of contemporary psychology. You know, it turns out that we can't even be in a group of people without instinctively mirroring and mimicking their opinions. Even about seemingly personal and visceral things like who you're attracted to, you will start aping the beliefs of the people around you without even realizing that that's what you're doing. And groups famously follow the opinions of the most dominant or charismatic person in the room, even though there's zero correlation between being the best talker and having the best ideas. I mean, zero. So, you might be following the person with the best ideas, but you might not. And do you really want to leave it up to chance? Much better for everybody to go off by themselves, generate their own ideas, freed from the distortions of group dynamics, and then come together as a team to talk them through in a well-managed environment and take it from there. Now, if all this is true, then why are we getting it so wrong? Why are we setting up our schools this way and our workplaces? And why are we making introverts feel so guilty about wanting to just go off by themselves some of the time? One answer lies deep in our cultural history. Western societies, and in particular the US, have always favored the man of action over the man of contemplation. And man of contemplation. But in America's early days, we lived in what historians call a culture of character, where we still, at that point, valued people for their inner selves and their moral rectitude. And if you look at the self-help books from this era, they all had titles with things like character, the grandest thing in the world. And they featured role models like Abraham Lincoln, who was praised for being modest and unassuming. Ralph Waldo Emerson called him a man who does not offend by superiority. But then we hit the 20th century, and we entered a new culture that historians call the culture of personality. You know, what happened is we had evolved from an agricultural economy to a world of big business. And so suddenly people are moving from small towns to the cities. And instead of working alongside people they've known all their lives, now they are having to prove themselves in a crowd of strangers. So quite understandably, qualities like magnetism and charisma suddenly come to seem really important. And sure enough, the self-help books change to meet these new needs. And they start to have names like How to Win Friends and Influence People. And they feature as their role models really great salesmen. So that's the world we're living in today. That's our cultural inheritance. Now, none of this is to say that social skills are unimportant. And I'm also not calling for the abolishing of teamwork at all. The same religions who send their sages off to lonely mountaintops also teach us love and trust. And the problems that we are facing today in fields like science and in economics are so vast and so complex that we are going to need armies of people coming together to solve them, working together. But I am saying that the more freedom that we give introverts to be themselves, the more likely that they are to come up with their own unique solutions to these problems. So now, I'd like to share with you what's in my suitcase today. Guess what? Books. I have a suitcase full of books. Here's Margaret Atwood, Cat's Eye. Here's a novel by Milan Kundera. And here's The Guide of the Perplexed by Maimonides. But these are not exactly my books. I brought these books with me because they were written by my grandfather's favorite authors. My grandfather was a rabbi, and he was a widower who lived alone in a small apartment in Brooklyn that was my favorite place in the world when I was growing up, partly because it was filled with his very gentle, very courtly presence, and partly because it was filled with books. I mean, literally, every table, every chair in this apartment had yielded its original function to now serve as a surface for swaying stacks of books. Just like the rest of my family, my grandfather's favorite thing to do in the world was to read. But he also loved his congregation, and you could feel this love in the sermons that he gave every week for the 62 years that he was a rabbi. He would take the fruits of each week's reading, and he would weave these intricate tapestries of ancient and humanist thought, and people would come from all over to hear him speak. But here's the thing about my grandfather. Underneath this ceremonial role, he was really modest and really introverted, so much so that when he delivered these sermons, he had trouble making eye contact with the very same congregation that he had been speaking to for 62 years. And even away from the podium, when you called him to say hello, he would often end the conversation prematurely for fear that he was taking up too much of your time. But when he died at the age of 94, the police had to close down the streets of his neighborhood to accommodate the crowd of people who came out to mourn him. And so these days, I try to learn from my grandfather's example in my own way. So I just published a book about introversion, and it took me about 7 years to write. And for me, that 7 years was like total bliss, because, you know, I was reading, I was writing, I was thinking, I was researching. It was my version of my grandfather's hours a day alone in his library. But now, all of a sudden, my job is very different, and my job is to be out here talking about it. Talking about introversion. And that's a lot harder for me, because as honored as I am to be here with all of you right now, this is not my natural milieu. So I prepared for moments like these as best I could. I spent the last year practicing public speaking every chance I could get, and I called this my year of speaking dangerously. And that actually helped a lot. But I'll tell you, what helps even more is my sense, my belief, my hope, that when it comes to our attitudes, to introversion, and to quiet, and to solitude, we truly are poised on the brink of dramatic change. I mean, we are. And so I am going to leave you now with three calls for action for those who share this vision. Number one, stop the madness for constant group work. Just stop it. Thank you. And I want to be clear about what I'm saying, because I deeply believe our offices should be encouraging casual, chatty, cafe-style types of interactions, you know, the kind where people come together and serendipitously have an exchange of ideas. That is great. That's great for introverts, and it's great for extroverts. But we need much more privacy, much more freedom, much more autonomy at work. School, same thing. We need to be teaching kids to work together, for sure. But we also need to be teaching them how to work on their own. This is especially important for extroverted children, too. They need to work on their own because that is where deep thought comes from, in part. Okay, number two, go to the wilderness. Be like Buddha. Have your own revelations. I'm not saying that we all have to now go off and build our own cabins in the woods and never talk to each other again. But I am saying that we could all stand to unplug and get inside our own heads a little more often. Number three, take a good look at what's inside your own suitcase and why you put it there. So extroverts, maybe your suitcases are also full of books. Or maybe they're full of champagne glasses or skydiving equipment. Whatever it is, I hope you take these things out every chance you get and grace us with your energy and your joy. But introverts, you being you, you probably have the impulse to guard very carefully what's inside your own suitcase, and that's okay. But occasionally, just occasionally, I hope you will open up your suitcases for other people to see, because the world needs you and it needs the things you carry.
Do you like being a participant in the watering can of the flowers of freedom throughout the world?
GoFindTheOthers.com.
Yeah, man, I tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.